Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz. Maine's newest Congressman Jared Golden is no stranger to combat. He is, after all, a former Marine infantryman who served tours in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Golden is also a former state legislator, so he knows about the verbal jousting that goes into lawmaking. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that Golden, just months into his congressional term, got into a verbal floor fight with U.S. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy over a campaign finance bill. We'll talk about that with Mal Leary and Steve Mistler in just a bit. But first, the most surprising political news this week comes from Lewiston, where the mayor, Shane Bouchard, resigned after a series of revelations mushroomed in the space of days. Steve Mistler gives us the background.
Bouchard won a very hotly contested mayoral race in 2017, arguably with the assistance of an anonymous website. It was anonymous at the time, that had obtained emails from his opponent, Ben Chin, a liberal activist for the Maine People's Alliance. And those emails, it's always been a mystery about how those emails were obtained by this site called the Maine Examiner, which, come to find out, was actually operated by Jason Savage, who's the executive director of the Maine Republican Party. But then on Tuesday, during a really sparsely attended Lewiston City Council meeting, a woman got up. Her name is Heather Everly. She got up during public comment with like three people in the room outside of the city council and basically said, "I had an affair with Shane Bouchard, the mayor, back in 2017. And I also worked for Ben Chin's campaign. And I gave him these very damaging emails, especially in the hands of a Republican operative." And so that really set off, just really reopened a controversy that we thought maybe was closed back in 2018. So we went out and we reported the story, you know, and called the mayor and said, "Hey, is this true? Did you actually get these emails from this woman?" And to my surprise, when I talked to the mayor on Wednesday, he admitted it. He said, "Yes, I did. I mean, he disputed the nature of the relationship, but he also admitted that he did know her and that she approached him and provided the emails, some related issues and text messages that he sent. More of those have been revealed since our story. And the ones that we received are interesting too, because in those text messages, the mayor is calling this woman his secret weapon. And turns out that may have been the case. But it's just fascinating because, you know, we have, you know, this covertly run website that was hauled before the Maine Ethics Commission, but which declined to investigate the matter. But they may have more fodder to do that.
All right. Now back to Washington, D.C., where a second district Democratic Congressman Jared Golden has apparently gone toe-to-toe with the Republican leader Kevin McCarthy over a campaign finance proposal. Mal, what's that all about?
Well, it's all part of H.R. 1, which, of course, is the big bill put forward by House Democrats to reform elections. Jared Golden was on the floor offering an amendment that was adopted that would provide a form of public financing for members of Congress. Well, as you might guess, Kevin McCarthy, who's the House Minority Leader, was furious and got up there, and we heard many of the same arguments we've heard here in Maine against public financing of elections, in which McCarthy blasted the proposal. Well, Golden gave as good as he got in terms of pointing out that in the state of Maine, voters twice have approved public financing.
In 1996, Maine voters actually voted for a public funding program in the state of Maine. And they liked the program so much that they actually upped the ante in 2015 through another voter referendum, where Maine voters actually voted to say, "We want to continue this program and we want to increase the funding to keep regular people competitive against the dark money that was flowing into elections in the state of Maine."
So he thinks he's on pretty solid ground, since the voters here have said that they want to have their candidates out there talking to them and talking about issues rather than dialing for dollars on the phone from various big corporate contributors. So it was a very interesting debate, but the amendment was adopted. And I suspect what's going to happen with this is it's going to go over to the Senate, never to be heard from again.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about that exchange, too, was I didn't expect Golden to respond to McCarthy the way he did, basically accusing him of using hateful rhetoric, you know, because he kept referring to the Democrats as socialists and
Democratic Socialist Party.
That's right. Yeah. And so Golden, you know, a freshman, stood right up to him, which was really interesting to see. I didn't expect that from Jared because he's typically pretty understated, but he did. He stood his ground, as Mal just described.
I want to mention, too, that the Senate went ahead and confirmed this week President Trump's nomination of Chad Riedler to a federal appeals court in the 6th District, which covers Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. Now, what's interesting about this is that Senator Susan Collins, a Republican, came out against Riedler. Steve, why don't you refresh our memory? Why was she opposed to him in the first place?
The central thrust of her opposition was that Riedler was not supportive of the Affordable Care Act. That, I think, is the real thrust of it right there.
Well, when he was in the Justice Department, he actually wrote one of the memos opposing the Affordable Care Act that was used fundamentally in the arguments by the Republicans in the House and Senate to repeal various provisions, including those that would protect pre-existing conditions, which has been a fundamental issue with Senator Collins, is to protect folks to make sure they could get coverage even with a pre-existing condition. So it was not surprising that she opposed him, but I think looking at the politics of it, it was far easier for her to do that, given that the Senate Republican majority is larger than it was. And instead of hers being a vote that defeated him, was simply a vote in opposition.
Yeah. And that brief, by the way, was also used in the legal case that a Texas judge used to rule that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. So can we expect to see Collins standing up to Trump perhaps more often because of that enhanced Republican majority?
I think so. I mean, it's a little safer for her to do that in some instances. I don't think she wants to be too far out in front. I mean, right now, there was an interesting statistic that I read this morning, actually, about how the Republicans who have opposed Trump's nominees or other proposals that he's put forward, she's second on that list of Republicans. And number one is Rand Paul from Kentucky. And if you recall, it was interesting with this emergency declaration of the president that I believe it was Collins who was first to oppose his emergency declaration.
Yes.
And I think after that, there were others, including Rand Paul, who I think made it pretty clear that that resolution that's going through Congress would actually pass. It may not be enough pending a presidential veto to overcome that, but it was interesting that she was first and then Rand Paul, I think, was the last Republican to voice his opposition.
It's also interesting that those two would be one and two because, of course, Rand Paul tends to come from a much more far-right libertarian view. Collins, on the other hand, coming to her opposition from a more moderate political stance.
But the two of them come together on this issue of violating the Constitution, that the Constitution is clear that Congress has to pass a law to appropriate money. And the president, using this emergency declaration, is diverting money that had been appropriated for one purpose for another purpose. And in fact, Mitch McConnell was on had a news conference a couple of days ago in which he said he could see 15 or 20 Republican senators abandoning the president on that issue, which means that resolution will pass the Senate. Of course, as Steve points out, there's not enough votes there to be a veto. But as this builds, there's the possibility that it's going to be a lot closer than you would expect, given the majority that the Republicans hold in the Senate.
Yeah, of course, there are institutional issues here, too, that kind of seem to rise above partisan politics for many of these senators, I think.
But yes, particularly that fundamental question of the Constitution and who could appropriate money for what.
All right, let's refocus back to our legislature. It has passed LD1. Now, that bill number often denotes a signature piece of legislation that the party in power would like to see enacted. Mal, what is in this version of LD1?
Well, it's interesting because this goes back to the same discussion we were just having about Senator Collins and pre-existing conditions. basically what this legislation does is provides a backstop if indeed the federal law dealing with the Affordable Care Act and its protections gets totally repealed. This would, in state law, say pre-existing conditions are covered. It also would allow what's called Public Law 90, which is a mechanism for providing funds to back up insurance policies, health insurance policies, on like a catastrophic illness basis, which is a big deal with the Republicans. So this bill went through the legislature overwhelmingly with support for both sides, because what it really does is just provide a backstop if the Affordable Care Act provisions are repealed. That's something they could all agree on. I'm not sure we'll see that many more of those coming forward.
Just to provide a little bit of more context here on that bill and why it became LD1, you know, healthcare and protecting the ACA and pre-existing conditions were central to Democrats, legislative Democrats, and their campaign message. I mean, this is what they campaigned on. So it was not a surprise that they led with this, A, because it would get bipartisan support, and B, it's ostensibly fulfilling a campaign promise.
All right. So this measure has had a vote on the floor. Is the legislature beginning to move towards floor action on more bills?
Oh, yeah. We've had, I'm guessing here, 14 or 15 bills signed into law by Governor Mills already. Bills are moving forward. Bills are being killed off every day with their in session. We will see 4, 5, 6, 7 bills killed out of committee unanimously. So that is action by the legislature. What we haven't seen yet is any of the big debates on controversial issues. They haven't come up yet, but I think we'll start seeing those by the end of the month.
But you're not counting the chickadee measure in that number, right? just
sadly, checking? No.
All right.
Well, I'm waiting to see what the actual vote was on that, if all 13 members voted to kill it or not.
Yeah, because only 10 were present for the
committee.
Only 10
were present for that vote. And even though that's a pretty strong indication that it's in trouble, until all 13 sign off, it's not dead.
Speaking of things that are still very much alive, the proposal by Central Maine Power to build that big transmission line across western Maine to bring hydropower to Massachusetts, the public advocate has come out at a hearing before the PUC in favor of it. Steve, what else is going on there?
Well, it was interesting, Barry Hobbins, the public advocate, not only did he come out in favor of it and testify yesterday during a hearing about the stipulation agreement, this $258 million package of benefits that helped get Governor Mills' support for the proposal. What was interesting is that there was a filing just before yesterday's hearing that detailed how that $258 million stipulation agreement came to be. It was basically a narrative or a TikTok of how the parties got together. I mean, that is unusual to see what are typically closed-door negotiations put into the public record this way. But what's also interesting about it is the narrative of it and how it was sort of cast as Barry Hobbins, the public advocate, and Tony Buxton, a lobbyist for the group representing industrial energy users, you know, basically getting CMP and other players to the table. You know, it's kind of like Art of the Deal, authored by the public advocate and Tony Buxton. And the narrative of this 22-page document is really something. And it does include some illuminating details of how this controversial deal went down. But one is really left with the impression that Hobbins and Buxton dragged CMP to the table after the company originally proposed no benefits to Maine ratepayers or anyone else, grabbed CMP officials by the ankles, flipped them upside down, and shook them until $250 million in benefits came tumbling out of their sharply tailored suits. You know, it's a very compelling story, but you have to wonder if it will be convincing to opponents of this project, which repeatedly note that the ratepayer benefits equal about $1.40 a month off their monthly bills. And environmental groups continue to be split on the idea that the project will do anything to reduce carbon emissions. That said, there are some interesting tidbits of information in this document, including this, which is that it appears that Tom Welch was advising Governor Mills on the project. Now, I'd heard this as a rumor.
We should say Tom Welch, former Public Utilities Commission chairman as well.
And also former, I don't know if he's an employee or a representative for CMP, which is also an interesting little wrinkle here. Nobody will doubt that Tom Welch knows his stuff on energy policy, so it was it was always a mystery who Mills was listening to here, because she didn't at the time have an energy director. She just announced one. But at that time, everybody was trying to figure out who was advising her. And it appears that Welch, apparently in a pro bono capacity, was part of what we would call a kitchen cabinet role. Mm. You know, he was basically advising her as these negotiations went forward, and I think helped her be reassured that this was a good deal. That is still very much in question. I think a lot of people still don't think it's enough, but this document did reveal how it came to be, and that was interesting.
Well, and of course, now we'll see. The PUC still has to rule on this, and then, of course, once it does, then the question will become whether or not the political powers that be will leap back into the fold, if you will.
There's a long regulatory process that goes beyond the PUC. This is going to need approval, for example, from the Department of Environmental Protection, mm-hmm. because of the route and the impacts it will have directly on the environment where they decide to build this thing. Mm. So this is going to be around for a while. This is not going to, simply because we now have the governor and the public advocate saying, we think it's a good deal, it's going to be a while before it gets through the process.
I'll just add one quick thing to Irwin's point, which is that there is a bill in the legislature, and I suspect there may be others that I haven't seen yet, but there is one bill that would basically prohibit the PUC from greenlighting a project like this if a local community has voted against it. What'll be interesting to see to me in a Democratic-controlled legislature is whether or not that bill actually comes forward. You know, you think about the politics of that. Do Democrats in a legislature potentially want to embarrass or be embarrassed by the governor on a proposal like that? So it'll be interesting to see if the legislature does try to get involved, especially with a project that is really divisive.
Yeah, and just this past week, Wilton, I think, became the latest community that says they don't want it in their backyard.
Overwhelmingly, too.
Steve Missler there, along with Mal Leary, and that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. The Pulse podcast is posted each Friday afternoon, and you can access it anytime at mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Past podcasts are also available. The Pulse also airs Sundays on Weekend Edition, and we air an abbreviated version Mondays on Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Join us again soon.